Good afternoon. I'm Albert. Peter Wolf is in studio. We got to do something about those headphones.
No, that looks good.
It's a mess.
If it's looking good, it's looking fine.
It's a mess. Thanks for coming.
Hey, I'm a mess, so that should be a mess, too.
Recently, I don't know, are you aware of the show that we run out of Philadelphia every Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock to 12? It's called World Cafe.
Sure.
Well,
I've appeared on it in Philadelphia.
When was that?
That was about 3 years ago.
Well, they approached us last November and asked us to come up with five different songs,
right,
or artists,
right,
that represented Boston, and you were at the top of the list.
Oh, well, I'm honored.
It was you and, I forget, it was Mark Sandman.
Right.
It was Jonathan Richman.
Right.
I forget who the other two were.
Well, it's all good company.
All good company. So anyway, are you getting sick about talking about your past yet?
No, but because I keep reinventing the future, so I don't mind stepping back. One back, two forward.
I got to say, you handled yourself admirably on The Daily Show.
Oh,
when was
thank
the
you.
When were the last time you were on like national TV?
Well, that was quite a while. Last time was, I think, David Letterman and national TV. There was one documentary I was in, several documentaries I was part of, but actual guest, I would say, The Daily Show, was for quite a while. Because we did have the pandemic that ate up a lot of time.
I kind of liked the pandemic at times.
Oh, I did too.
Yeah, because
not the disease itself,
no,
but the sheltering.
But as long as you could stay home and have stuff delivered to you and you're surrounded by loved ones, does it get any better?
No, I never had anything delivered. But what I did like was it gave me the opportunity to read everything I wanted to read and to listen to everything I wanted to listen to, and I could still use another couple of months of still catching up.
Okay, let's get to the book. Waiting on the Moon.
Yes.
That's the reason why you're here, last I checked.
Well, thank you.
What got all this brewing? Is this something you've wanted to do for a long, long time, or is it just something that kind of maybe during the pandemic occurred to you to work on?
Well, during the pandemic, most of my friends, all the Midnight Travelers, the gentlemen, the great talents that I work with and travel with on the road, they were doing Patreon sites and writing all different kinds of songs and going in, still recording. And I just sat around and read and listened to music. And I was also finishing up a new recording.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a CD that's, a new recording that's, probably 85% finished. And I was thinking, well, if I finish this and put it out, it'll be in the ether in 48 hours.
Sure.
Excuse me. So people always said to me, Pete, you should write a book. You tell stories on stage. You tell stories backstage. You're always at, parties, yakking about this or that, and you've known so many people. I figured, well, instead of doing a CD and releasing that,
mm-hmm,
maybe it's time to do the book.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had contacted previously an agent, a gentleman that's very well known in the book world, Andrew Wiley, and he handles Salman Rushdie and Martin Amis and the Philip Roth estate and the Saul Bellow estate, and he's a pretty big guy, and he loved the idea of the book, because I said I didn't want to write a book that's like a regular musician's autobiography.
Right, beginning and middle.
Yeah, I saw the Beatles, or I saw the Elvis on Ed Sullivan, and then I got my first guitar, etc. My concept was to write these stories and make them each like a short story. So there's about 30-something chapters in the book, and so each one is like its own short story. So someone can buy the book and read chapter 17 or read chapter 8, and they work. There's a timeline, but each chapter has its own beginning, middle, and end.
Was it hard putting your music on the back burner while you focused on this book?
It was. It was really hard to sort of decide, I'm going to cancel all shows and call up the agent. And I remember Mick Jagger said, oh man, I'm not going to do a book. Why take 2 years of my life just thinking about, all sorts of, you know, facts and this and that. And he was quite right. It took over 2 years, and I didn't think it would take that long. But once I started, I just couldn't stop. And just the research alone, for instance, I remember writing this passage where at the Sheraton Hotel in Boston, mm-hmm. the Rolling Stones mm-hmm. were playing, and they took over the entire top floor. They had all the security by the elevator, and all the doors on the floor were open, all the band members. It was like one big party in the hallway, and people were coming and going.
Shocking.
Yes. And I remember walking by a room and being called in, and sitting on the floor was Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, and Graham Parsons, all playing acoustic guitars, singing Merle Haggard's Sing Me Back Home.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote it, and I was typing away. And I also wanted to do research to make sure my memory served me well. And I realized, wait a second, Graham Parsons died a year before that tour. So I definitely remember him being in the room. So after research and some phone calls, I realized it was Mick Jagger sitting on the floor playing acoustic guitar, Keith Richards sitting on the floor. But it was Keith telling me he learned the Merle Haggard song from Graham Parsons.
I see.
And so I just, my memory got it cloudy and assumed Graham was there, because I knew Graham when he was, you know, going to Harvard for about 8 minutes. And we go to a lot of the country clubs here in Boston. Hillbilly Ranch.
Hillbilly Ranch.
Yeah. And
did you go up to the Blue Star?
Blue Star. Definitely Blue Star. And COP, which is a country radio station, they would have annual concerts at Symphony Hall. And so they had the whole Bakersfield concerts and Johnny.
Were they local?
Yes.
Wasn't there a country music station out of Brockton that you and Eddie Gwardetsky used to go down and hound that guy? Do you remember that? It was on Sunday nights.
Well, on Brockton, there used to be Bill, he did doo-wop shows.
Yeah.
And I would go down, and actually I DJ'd there sometimes when he couldn't make it. But that was on, that was the only station I remember in Brockton. It was doo-wop.
You know, speaking of Keith Richards, you must have read his book.
Oh, yeah. And we're on the same publishing company.
What amazed me is that... his memory. And I think the same serves for you as well. What is it? Is it genetic? Is it... I mean, I don't remember what I did yesterday.
No, it's true. Short-term memory is one thing. Long-term memory, I'm really clear with. And I like you, I can't tell you. I would have to think about yesterday. But when I'm thinking about, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, mm-hmm. The first time I remember Springsteen or Little Steven coming up to say hello when they, before they became the E Street Band in New Jersey in 1971, wow. I can almost remember what they were wearing. It's uncanny. I can't quite believe it myself, but I do.
Was the, you know, you played a big part in the Ryan Walsh book. You know, the one about Van Morrison, Astral Weeks,
right.
Correct? Was that any sort of incentive for you to focus on your book or to get your book started?
Well, I actually didn't take part in the Ryan's book because the book started as an article for Boston Magazine. And, you know, Van being very private, mm-hmm. I felt that I didn't really want to reveal too much of our friendship because I just felt... that was one of the things that one had to protect. If you're going to be a friend, you had to sort of protect that. And when I was doing the book on Waiting on the Moon, there's a chapter on Van, mm-hmm. when he first came to town, how we first met, you know.
At the Plow and Stars.
Well, it ends at the Plow and Stars.
Exactly.
And I'll tell you a very funny story. Van.
Funnier than that one?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's odd. It's an odd coincidence.
Okay.
Van had played up in New Hampshire at a small club, jazz club, about maybe 5 months ago or longer. I can't see, that's the memory. I can't remember that. But he was playing at Jerry's or something, a jazz club in New Hampshire, and then going out playing some dates in West Coast. And we had met at this hotel. We were sitting outside, and I told him, recaptured the story that I write in the book, about us, trying to get something to eat at the Plow and the Stars,
mm-hmm.
and the bartender mm-hmm. just refused to serve us until he realized,
right.
as we left, that, oh my God, this is the Irish Plow and the Stars, and there's the great, Bard of Ireland asking for something to eat and drink, and we refused him. And so he comes rushing out into the street, saying, Van, come back. That same bartender, when I was telling Van that story several months ago, that same bartender was sitting in the hotel bar and came out like 5 minutes after I retold the story to Van. And there he was, the same bartender. It was bizarre. Of course, Van didn't want to speak to him. He said, get him out of here. But
is that your Van Morrison imitation?
It's a bad one.
Yeah. That's the kind of stuff you see in movies, really.
I know.
But the best thing about the book is that it's such an easy read and such a fascinating read. I think I speak for thousands of people, or maybe tens of thousands at this point in time. I'm enamored. But it's almost like I'm sitting in the room with you, maybe having a shot or two of good Southern bourbon or something, and you're regaling us with tales. Did you have to embellish at all?
No. What I really set out to do was not write about me, but write about all the people that I was privileged to meet. And when I read other musicians' book, I remember reading, which was a pretty good book, Robbie Robinson's book.
Yeah, I read it.
And he talks about, going down south and how they ran into Sonny Boy Williamson and blah, 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 blah. But you don't get a picture of what Sonny Boy was like, and he's someone that really fascinated me. And so what I tried to attempt to do was really write about sort of Christopher Isherwood, who's a writer, who wrote a book called
Sure.
Berlin Stories,
yeah.
and that became Cabaret, with the movie and the play, was based on this book called Berlin Stories. And he has a line in there, I am a camera with the shutter always open. And so I tried to use that as my template for capturing all these amazing artists, mm-hmm. writers, poets, and just ordinary people who wouldn't know, and try to bring them to life. What was it like sitting down writing a song with the great Don Covey, who wrote Chain of Fools for Aretha Franklin, songs for Otis Redding, and songs for, what was it like being in Julia Child's kitchen? What was it like, visiting Alfred Hitchcock?
Which, not
from my point of view.
Right.
But what were they like?
But that's very unselfish of you. And, musicians are renowned for their egos. So this is your approach to writing this book is very refreshing, I think.
Well, there's Truman Capote has a book called Dogs Bark, and he did these short stories about him meeting Marlon Brando on the set of Sayonara, mm-hmm. and Mal Monroe and his time with Humphrey Bogart. But it was all about them, and
right.
that's what I found so interesting about it. And so I tried to emulate, bringing the characters that I admired, that I was really thrilled to meet and felt that I had the great honor of spending time with, be it, Stones or, Dylan or whatever, and just try to share somewhat of my experience, but for them, bring them to life. I'm just there. I'm the camera, but they're the picture.
You're the liaison, so
yes.
to speak.
The
so, for the uninitiated, the book, Waiting on the Moon, there's Dylan, there's Andy Warhol, there's Marilyn Monroe, there's Van Morrison, Muddy Waters, and I'm going to show you this flyer I came across the other day, and I was hoping maybe you could encapsulate one of my favorite stories in the book, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
Oh, wow. Yes, John Lee Hooker and the Hallucinations at the Boston Tea Party. Thursdays and Saturday, also appearing Quill. I remember Quill quite well. So, another thing I have to say is what I try to do, and what you do every day here, is you are DJ, meaning you're playing the music, you choose the music,
mm-hmm.
you try to go for your taste, and, share to the listening audience. That's what makes your show mm-hmm. what it is. And that's what makes every, you know, disc jockey that has the freedom like you have here to play. And so what I chose to do is, like a DJ, because I was a DJ, as we both know, share, instead of records, but share the musical experiences of people that I got to meet. So in a sense, I was acting as a DJ and writing the book.
So the John, I hate to harp on this, but I thought this was the greatest thing in the whole world, the John Lee Hooker, you hooked up with him, and you talked your way into opening for him,
right,
and bringing in people that he had not gotten the night before. But
right.
then there was a, was there not a bust involved down deep in the South End and things?
It was a, it was quite, the John Lee Hooker chapter is it's quite an adventure. And to summarize it real quickly, he was playing at a club, folk club called the Odyssey. And it was quite a large club, and we got there real early, me and the lead guitar player of my first band, the Hallucinations.
So the Odyssey would have been before the Boston Tea Party?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, and way before.
And where was the Odyssey?
The Odyssey was in Beacon Hill, and Beacon Hill had many folk
like
clubs.
Like Charles Street?
It was Cambridge Street.
Okay.
Upstairs, it became a karate studio, and it was quite a big place. And John, there was, we got there about 6 o'clock, and we got to meet Mr. Hooker as he got out of the car and escorted him up the steps to the club. And there was only about 20 people that showed up, mm-hmm. and we couldn't believe it. You know, this was, you know, the great John Lee Hooker. And so I talked to him, you know, said, "Look, we're art students. We have a band. We could fill this place, you know, tomorrow for you. We'll spread the word." And he said, "Look, can't pay you guys." I said, "No, we don't want to pay. We just want to have the honor of playing with you." His big concern was, "You guys don't play loud," which we did. But we said, "Oh, no, Mr. Hooker, we play really low." Long story short, we get to play for him, and that started the beginning of a very long friendship until the day he died. And every time John would come into town, we would get together, different blues artists from around here, Dave Maxwell, the great piano player and mm-hmm. stuff. We'd all meet John backstage and then go to the hotel room with him after. And he was, I tried to bring his charm, and he was so generous to people and to other artists. And he had a great effect on Bob Dylan, because one of Bob's first big dates was opening up for John Lee Hooker at Gertie's Folk City in New York. And John told me that Bob would come up to his hotel every night asking him about how he did certain tunings and all this. And Van Morrison is a huge John Lee Hooker fan. So John played, had a big effect on many musicians. Jimi Hendrix, people don't really associate Jimi Hendrix with John Lee Hooker, but if you listen to some of Hooker's soloing and stuff, you know that Hendrix really picked up a lot of the tunings and style from John Lee.
Above and beyond the big names, another favorite part of my book was your encounter and interaction with a fellow named Ed Hood.
Ah.
Who reminded me a lot of some of the people I grew up with out in the Midwest, the Deep South, and was lucky enough to encounter. The fact that he was in Harvard Square holding court, and you were part of that, I just found fascinating.
Now, you were from Kentucky, were you?
That is correct, sir.
Yeah, because I remember us talking about, you know, the home of the great bourbons.
Yes.
Kentucky being the home of great bourbons. And at one point, the only place officially that bourbon was made.
That is correct.
Other than Sour Mash was Tennessee.
That is correct.
Yeah. But Ed Hood came from Alabama. He was a tuté of the great poet Alan Tate and worked with Cal Lowell, the other one of our greatest dean poets. And he was a gentleman that lived on the first floor of this building outside of Harvard Square when artists could live and afford Harvard Square. So in my building, there was all filled with musicians, Charles Giuliano, writers, painters. Ed Hood had a little salon where he would have people come and go. Some of them were Andy Warhol. Some of them were, oh boy, see there, is Runaway. Del Shannon, and you never knew who you'd meet at Ed's place. And
I thought you were going to say Joe D'Alessandro.
Oh, yes, he was with the Warhol. But Velvet Underground would hang out at Ed's place. And
well, did they not play Boston more than they played New York?
They were bigger in Boston and New England than they were in New York. As a matter of fact, they played, I think, 10 times more times here in Boston, the New England area, than they did. They only did very few shows in New York, so they were much bigger here. And so Ed came from the South, and he was a great scholar. And he was the gentleman that really taught me how to really read and how to get deep inside the book, and gave me a list of the great authors and the great books. And through him, I really owe whatever literary knowledge I do have. Mm-hmm. It came from him. And he was a very eccentric character. He was gay at a time when Harvard University didn't really appreciate people who talked freely about their homosexuality. And eventually they had him removed, which was very cruel. And it's all in the chapter. But Ed was an amazing, funny, interesting character that I still miss and learned so much from.
He reminded me, do you know a guy named Harry Crosby?
Yes, but Harry Crosby from the 20s.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, for some reason,
through the Fitzgerald era.
Exactly. I thought the two of them, they reminded me of each other.
There's a book on his life called Black Sun.
I have it.
Ah, yeah. As do I, thanks to Ed Hood, you see. Because Ed, like you, was from the South, from Birmingham. His mother was friends of Adora Welty, the great Southern writer. And I remember Ed, if anyone really wants to read two stories that really opened me up, was the Hemingway's short story, The Killers. But you have to forgive him for some of the language he uses. It's not PC at all. And William Faulkner's A Rose for Emily, one of the real first great Gothic Southern short stories. Again, one has to overlook some of the language there.
I was always a Light in August guy.
Oh yeah, me too.
Nathaniel West too.
But I don't know if Nathaniel was Southern. But it was the greatest. Day of the Locust, great Hollywood.
Miss Lonely Hearts.
Oh, yes. Yes. But those are the only two that I can recall.
No, I think he only wrote four short stories.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Anyway, I was reading some, you know, there's been a lot of great reviews, and you've done a lot of interviews lately. Someone mentioned that you were like Zelig in this book. You know, the Woody Allen movie from way back when? Does that make sense to you? You can just say no.
No.
Or the other thing we were talking about is how you can just pick a chapter and go to the chapter and not lose anything. It's somewhat like watching Pulp Fiction.
Yes, I would say that's true. I mean, the way Tarantino put together Pulp Fiction, there is really no beginning, middle, and end. Once you get the characters, there's just different adventures. And so very much so like Waiting on the Moon. That's a good call.
So one of the things that amazed me about this, especially when you were young in the Bronx going to Manhattan, is that you were fearless, you were tenacious. And I would think you would credit your parents for instilling perhaps your sense of adventure. How's that?
That would be true. My politics and sense of adventure. My father definitely was involved in the arts. And by being with him and his brother, his older brother, was a manager. And he managed a baton twirler, champion, the world's strongest man, a ventriloquist, you know, people that spin plates and stuff, and all that Broadway Danny Rose thing.
Yeah.
His office was in the Automat on the 42nd Street, right next to Jack Dempsey's. And I'd go visit my Uncle Harry, and, you know, there were all these wild people, you know, these clowns and different comedians and, you know, people who worked in the Bosch Belt and went out. And with the end of vaudeville, and I got to meet all these great, great characters that had these long careers, and they were at the end of the careers. And so through my father, he introduced me to ballerinas and opera singers, and it was so funny. He had a radio show, because he was a singer, and the radio show was called The Boy Baritone. And it was a 15-minute show where he would sing new songs from Tin Pan Alley. And he got to interview people like Fats Waller and things. Wow. And so my dad introduced me to lots of amazing musicians, jazz, folk music. And I remember...
Opened your mind.
Oh, definitely. And I remember bringing the first Bob Dylan record into my house in the Bronx. And my dad looked at the cover and said, "That's Bobby." And I go, "What?" He goes, "Yeah, that's Bobby." I said, "Dad, you know Bob Dylan?" He said, "Oh, yeah." I go out, have lunch with him at Izzy Young, who managed Bob Dylan early on.
Right.
And owned the place called the Folklore Center in the Village. Was good friends of my dad.
Right.
And he would go out and have, you know, lunches with Bob Dylan and Tiny Tim. And so, yeah, it was...
It's safe to say, in your case especially, that you were born at the right time.
Well, you know, we think about that, but I always think that, I think 20 years from now, this might be the right time for people 20 years on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, remembering before AI, remember the days before this, remember how great it used to be when we just had our cell phones, and you know, things are going to change so dramatically in 20 years. I mean, before the 50s, there was, you know, the great 20s and Paris in the 20s.
Sure.
And so I don't know. I am privileged that I was able to capture and remember these great artists and meet them. And that's what the book is about. It's trying to share the adventures.
Of all the people you've encountered in your life, who made you the most nervous?
Well,
if anybody.
Well,
and was it because maybe you were young or because of their stature in your eyes? Does that make sense?
Well, I was very nervous meeting Alfred Hitchcock. I was very nervous, but I was kind of drunk when I sat down and had my first long conversation with Bob Dylan. I think some of the, as I think about it, you know, I'm a nervous kind of person anyway, so I think I tend to be nervous anyway.
I would have loved to been a fly on the wall when Dylan, later on, after you, I mean, for lack of a better term, in a lot of ways, hounded him.
Stalk would be okay.
Yeah, stalked him. You know, when all of a sudden the light bulb went off and he put two and two together, that you were one and the same of the guy who used to encounter him and stalk him, your term, on the streets of Manhattan.
Well, you see, I met Bob. He was behind a curtain singing, and I became infatuated with the voice, like I did with Elvis. And this was, I think, the second week he arrived in New York. And so I...
61?
Yeah. Wow. And so I followed him at all the different places, the Café Wa and the Gaslight and the Gertie's, you know, Hootenannies and stuff. So I saw an early Dylan who was quite an incredible entertainer, very funny, spoke a lot to the audience, and was doing, you know, few of his own original songs, but a great many of the folk songs, but in a way that no one else did it. He was just so mesmerizing. And I try to capture that, too.
You did.
Oh,
is there anybody throughout your life that you wished you had crossed paths with but did not?
Oh, there's quite a few. I mean, one who I crossed paths with but never had the moments I would like to have. There was a gentleman that owned a restaurant called Hammersley here in town.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And,
down in the South End on Tremont Street.
And he was the sous chef to this young...
Gordon Hammersley.
Gordon Hammersley, correct. He was the sous chef to this guy, Wolfgang Puck, who had a restaurant in L.A. called Ma Maison. He was, before he opened up this restaurant, Spago's. And I would go there and meet with this manager, Irving Azoff, this new young manager. And there was a back terrace. And sitting there every afternoon, smoking a cigar, eating about two meals, and drinking about three, maybe four bottles of wine, was Orson Welles. And we would have to, at one point, Mr. Wells would, the driver would come in and go, Mr. Wells, it's time to leave. And Mr. Wells had somewhat of a hard time getting up from the table. So Gordon, myself, and Mr. Spagos, we would have to help Mr. Wells into the car. And but I never got a chance to really have a one-on-one. He's someone that totally intrigued me.
Anybody else?
Oh, I could
come to mind.
Oh, a lot of people. Don't stop me. In the words of Sonny Boy Williamson, don't stop me talking. I'll tell you everything I know.
There are sad parts in the book. I found, especially, it's funny, I just watched a documentary, your encounter with Harry Nilsson. Just made me sad.
It made me sad, too. And I had at the end of that chapter, which was taken out, I was in a lawyer's office who made a lot of money on Harry. This was at the end of Harry's career. And Harry was calling up. He said he had some new songs and he was looking for a record deal. And the secretary came in and said, Harry Nilsson's on the phone.
So what year would you say this was?
Yeah. Oh, no, that would take me...
late 70s, early 80s?
Early 80s,
yeah.
In the 80s.
Yeah.
And he said, tell him I'm not in. And turned to me and said, oh, man, that guy's just, you know, pain in the ass.
Right.
And I thought of, like, you know, he made a lot of money on Harry Nilsson. And he was an artist.
Right.
And at least give him... you know, talk to him, see what he wants, give him, you know, whatever. I mean, he deserved, you know, not being told what he was being told. So that was very sad. And Harry was quite a brilliant, unfortunately destructive character, but he was an amazing mind. And in the book, he's trying to tell this limousine driver how to save certain money from his fees so he can end up going into these certain stocks, and was writing these different stocks that he can invest as, you know, $5 here, $10 there.
Yep.
And then in 15 years, he'd be able to buy his own limousine and start his own company.
Right.
But Harry wasn't kidding. He had it all figured out.
Well, Mr. Wolf, I could sit here and talk with you all afternoon. We always suspected you had an interesting life, but we had no idea. We really had no idea.
Well,
and I can't recommend the book enough. It's whether you're a fan of Peter Wolf, or if you're a fan of just how do I say it? It's all-encompassing.
Well,
there's something for everybody.
But let me interrupt you, and I say this. I am honored to be here because what UMB stands for means so much to me in this community because it's my favorite radio station.
Oh,
and
thanks.
I love all the, you know, syndicated shows you have on Saturday and, you know, Lost Highway and, you know, things from Philly and just... you know, I find myself with a pad and pencil all the time writing down because there's so many artists that I'm unaware of that I first hear on UMB. So I think it's a treasure, and it's the last of really radio that you and I were part of in the early days of WBCN when the jocks had, you know, their own taste and were able to play and had the freedom to play all different kinds of things. So I really not only appreciate you talking about the book, but having me come down and let me make an endorsement to UMB because it's listener sponsored, and these days we need to, you know, stand up and support things like this station because it's a real value to all musicians and the community in itself.
I appreciate that. We try. We're trying.
Well, you it's going to get my sense is things are going to get even tougher. As days go on, and I think, you know, one of the ways people can fight back is by supporting things like the NPRs, the, you know, UMBs, you know, the stations that have the freedom to do what they choose, and it's rarer and rarer and rarer.
The book is Waiting on the Moon, Artists, Poets, Drifters, Grifters, and Goddesses. And it's not only a pretty perfect book, but that's a pretty perfect description as well. Because there's one, if not five or ten, of every one of those angles in your life.
I'll take the goddesses.
Oh, why did you put them at the bottom then?
You always save the best for last.
And I didn't even bring up Faye Dunaway.
Well, it's okay. I bring her up.
You mentioned you had music. We are a music station. You said you're 85% finished with some new music.
Yes.
And when can we expect that?
Well, that's what I'm working out now, and I'm speaking with the Midnight Travelers, and we're planning to get out there on the highways and byways hopefully soon, and so that's being talked about now. But I'm still just finishing up promoting, you know, the book tour, which, you know, takes a kind of full-time energy.
Well, didn't you go to Los Angeles too
for quite a few years? Yeah, been L.A., on the way to Detroit, Chicago.
Oh, perfect.
Down in D.C. We had a big event at the Kennedy Center, which I chose to cancel for obvious reasons.
I heard that.
And I'm just trying to... I spent a lot of time working on the book, and I just felt I could do... The book world is quite different these days, and so you need to be out there if you want it to be read, and so here I am.
Well, thanks for fitting us into your agenda, and as soon as that music's out, we want you right back here, sir.
I will be here. I'd love to play DJ. You and I get together. I'll bring a bottle of Kentucky's finest, and people can get in touch with me at peterwolf@peterwolf.com. And I hope you do enjoy the book. It was made for my fans and anyone else who likes to read.
Thank you, sir.
All right, Abyssinia's got to come out because that's what rock and roll is all about. This is Wolf of Goo with Mama Toofy. They're doing a tour, getting right through it, having a little fun until the midnight sun. Let it roll.